Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and am now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Tom Harden for a conversation on ethics education. We'll explore Tom's extraordinary journey from a middle-class upbringing in Atlanta to a career in hedge funds to, amazingly, becoming an FBI informant in some of the largest financial crime cases in history. And finally, to his current role as one of the world's foremost trainers on ethics. Tom is the founder of TipperX, one of the world's leading firms in ethics and compliance training. He has advised many investment firms and regulators on ethics and compliance. Tom is a recognized expert and his work has been featured all over the world, such as at Stanford Law School, Harvard Business School, the United States Attorney's Office, Compliance Asia, and the Middle East and Africa Compliance Association. Tom is a graduate of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Tom, it's great to have you on. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. So just as we start, before we learn about TipperX, first we'd love to learn about Tom. So please tell us a bit about your upbringing, where you're raised, a bit about your family and your journey before you entered the hedge fund world.
Absolutely. So I'm American, grew up in the state of Georgia in the southern United States, outside of Atlanta. Father worked his whole career at the Coca-Cola company there in Atlanta. My mother ran a daycare center in our home, a childcare center. And so just hardworking parents. I was the oldest of three brothers, soccer player, growing up and a good student. So it was really picture the quintessential middle-class, American family in the 1980s, 1990s, a very, very loving upbringing and a great place, to grow up.
Love to learn, continue to learn more about your childhood as well as your brothers. So maybe a little bit about your brothers and where they are today. Are they all in the US or elsewhere? As well as from your perspective, some of the formative experiences of that childhood.
Sure. Yeah. So I had two younger brothers. One, the middle brother, is now in South Carolina. He was in the investment business and now he has his own company, advising private equity companies on target acquisitions. And my youngest brother is in the paralegal business since he's still in Georgia. So I left the South, the only one to leave. My parents are both still alive and retired there. You know, as far as formative experiences, I just remember watching my parents sacrifice for us. We didn't have a lot of money. My father bought our small ranch home for $45,000 US back in 1978. And, you know, they just made sure we had everything we needed. So seeing their work ethic, loyalty, how much they gave up so that we could have these opportunities to succeed really stuck with me. Myself and my middle brother were the first of our high schools to go outside, really the South, and attend an Ivy League institution. He went to Harvard, I went to Penn. So we really overshot what was sort of around us, you know, at that time when we were growing up. I would say it created a deep sense of responsibility to succeed. Almost like I owed it to them to really succeed and to go for it and to do something that others around me really hadn't done before as far as just getting into a great university and trying to succeed. So I think also as the oldest child, the oldest of three brothers, I was the one that I was always trying to set the example. So trying to be the good kid, always chasing approval, always chasing grades, awards, achievements. And there was a real sense of a drive to be liked to fit in and perform at a really high level. So I think when we get to it later, some of those patterns laid the groundwork for some of the decisions I made later on in my career.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that, both about your family and as well some of what's meaningful to you in the sacrifices that your parents made and you living that out later on in your own work ethic. I'm interested as well in some of your interests outside of work. So you briefly mentioned that soccer was a big part of your childhood. So what are some of the things that you enjoy doing outside of work today?
So today I have two teenage daughters, so that keeps me busy. I feel like every few months I have more gray hair to show off, but it's they're the love of my life, and really just get to spend a lot of time with them and kind of see how they think and really kind of try to shape their own moral compass given what I went through, which we'll talk about, and not being a helicopter parent, but more planting seeds in their mind rather than dictating choices. So when they come with a question, rather than answering that, just sort of planting seeds and having them make their own decisions. I'm really into, I don't play soccer anymore, but I got into running marathons and ultra marathons. So, the Conrad's there is on my bucket list. One day I hope to run that. And I also am recently into master's boxing. So completely different, one combat sport, one endurance sport. But what I like about both of them is you learn to sit in discomfort. So if you're at mile 75 of a 100-mile race, that's one type of discomfort. Or recently during a sparring bout, I got hit in the liver for the first time. That's also a different type of discomfort. But I learn a lot going through the discomfort, whether it's dealing with teenage daughters or actually these athletic pursuits.
I think the word is an understatement there when you say discomfort. I think being punched in the face is not quite discomfort. I think it's something a little worse than discomfort.
It's a little shock.
Have you managed to get either of your two teenage daughters into soccer?
They are both dancers. So they don't need me to be coaching them there. But they love it. They love to perform on stage. They always sign up for solo performances. So I think I find a lot of teenagers today don't have, not to generalize, but sort of great interpersonal skills sometimes with the pandemic and coming out of that. And even being able to make eye contact is a plus with a teenager today. And I'm really proud of them that they get out there on stage, they perform in front of judges. And I think that's really building some confidence for them. And I'll say that going through what I went through, we'll talk about later, just having that really close relationship as a father to daughters is something I would never, never trade for or trade away from.
That's wonderful, Tom. I'm a father of two daughters as well, so I identify with a lot of what you're saying there. Although mine are still a lot younger.
Okay.
So
okay.
Really appreciate you sharing there about your childhood and your family. So I think let's move on then to your journey as Tipper X. So you've mentioned that you grew up in the suburbs outside of Atlanta in Georgia, and then an Ivy League experience for college. So walk us through then your journey in the hedge fund industry following that and becoming Tipper X.
So I got to the Wharton undergraduate program there. I thought I wanted to be a CPA. All my friends' successful parents were CPAs where I grew up. And then I became enamored with the markets. When I got there freshman year, some of the other students had been trading their own, either bar mitzvah money or money that they had through high school in the stock markets. And I became very enamored with that, joined the stock picking club at Wharton. But first I had to sort of get my experience in investment banking. So at the time, you either went with investment banking or consulting. After a couple hundred hour work weeks in investment banking, any analyst knows what that's about. I got recruited to start working at a hedge fund. So this is going back over 20 years, right around the top of the tech stock bubble in the early 2000s. Started working at a tech stock focused hedge fund in Connecticut, outside New York City. And in my 20s, I love covering tech stocks because as a hedge fund, we're long and short. You can always be betting on the disruptor, so the new company coming in. And there was always legacy companies that you could be short. We'd call them melting ice cubes, where they just couldn't change fast enough, trying to sort of change the direction of an aircraft carrier when you have a new entrant coming in. So one example that after Google went public in 2004, about a year later of following the company, I said, all these yellow page companies, there was actually six publicly traded yellow page companies. I said, these are going away. And so that one investment, long gold, Google, short yellow pages, would have made my career, but I didn't see it come to fruition for reasons that we're going to talk about soon. But I loved it. But I also became aware.
Oh, by the way, Tom, those door stops from yellow pages are really important. That's a really important function that I'd pay money for. So
no, sorry about that. Yeah. I had that as a risk factor in the thesis. No. So Yeah, people today have no idea what Yellow Pages are, right? So that was at the time, or you know, when the iPhone came out, and I remember it was J.P. Morgan, excuse me, was one of the first banks to adopt the iPhone for corporate email. And so you looked at these BlackBerries and thought, we're not going to need these anymore. So being able to do long and short tech stocks, I loved it. But I also became aware that insider trading was going on mid-early 2000s. And what this looked like at other tech stock-focused funds was that they would hire analysts at their funds who would worked at Silicon Valley companies. So you can imagine at the time, maybe Yahoo or Intel, those were some of the biggest companies going back 20 years. 25 years, those individuals would go be analysts at tech stocks, tech-focused hedge funds. And what they would do there is they would call back to their contacts inside the companies to get information around two events in the markets, upcoming earnings announcements and potential or upcoming M&A announcements. So it got to the point in the mid-2000s where 60% of companies before they were acquired had these unexplained spikes and the share prices before the news came out. So you could see on the news wire on Monday morning, Merger Monday, Company A or private equity company buys a public company, and you could see that target company, the stock price running up for days and days in advance, even call options going off. So I knew this was happening. I never felt initially that I needed to cross that line. I was doing quite well as an investor, looking at my sort of DCFs, looking out three to five years and you know, modeling cash flows, trying to figure out free cash flow growth, doing all the right things that I learned in school as an investor. But one pivotal moment at my second and final hedge fund was my boss made our goals very short term. So we started investing with a 3 to 5 year horizon thematically on some of the investment ideas I just previously mentioned. But after losing money in the first quarter of our first year of investing, he kind of panicked, came into my office when I was 28 years old. And said, we have to start looking for shorter term opportunities to make money every month. So when any goal in any business, I'd argue, goes from 3 to 5 years to monthly, the opportunity to start looking to potentially cut corners certainly increases. And I'd also say the ambiguity and the message he gave to me to do what it takes, and me looking back, not asking any clarifying questions as the analyst. What do you mean? Are you talking about anything goes? Because we know that other people are doing this, plays a huge part in what happens next. I can pause there or keep going.
Please, I'd actually love for you to pause there, Tom, because there's already so much in what you've said. One bit that I'd love to double click on is the atmosphere within the hedge fund industry at the time. What was it like? How were the stakes in a, let's say, a good year? How much was a star analyst making at a hedge fund?
Yeah, so in a good year, as for a duration focused long short fund, you know, you could be making high seven figures. In a good year, if you were at one of the multi managers, you know, you could be making eight figures at a very young age, and so that was money I had never seen in my life. I mean, that was something that was just beyond my wildest comprehension. So that was definitely a factor. You know, and also it was kind of the Wild West. There's this thing in the US called Regulation FD, where before that came out in the early 2000s, management teams would tell their favorite analysts kind of what was happening coming up. And today we would look at that as clear violation of the insider trading laws. But at the time, it was still kind of a Wild West. If you had these relationships at the public companies and you could call in there and get privileged information, it was happening pretty rapidly. So there wasn't as much focus as there is now from the SEC in the US on this at the time. And it kind of just felt like, it honestly felt like everybody was doing it at that time.
Got it. I think that's really important, that combination of the pressure and the stakes and how much you can make, as well as this feeling that everyone is doing it and it's pervasive in the industry. Let's move forward then from there. So I think you've painted the picture of the industry and what it felt like. Let's maybe move on in some of your next decisions then in your journey.
Sure. So a few months after that meeting with my boss, I received a phone call from another analyst I knew. I suspected that she was trading on inside information. She was always very much talking about rumors from Silicon Valley and never had tipped me, but it always seemed like she was sort of sticking her chest out, so to speak, about the contact she had in Silicon Valley. She calls me one day and says, Tom, you've made me a lot of money over the last few years. on some great ideas, sort of the long Google, short Yellow Pages, or Apple and RIM. And she said, I have something for you now, but you can't tell anybody. Now, that should have set off some red flags, but of course I said, keep going. And she told me that a Moody's analyst had told her from the bond rating agency that a listed company was going to be acquired in a few weeks. Here's the date. Here's the price. Here's the private equity firm. If you heard that conversation, you would know it's illicit. You don't have to understand the law to know that that was an illicit tip of inside information. I didn't make any trades that day. It sounded so illegal, like, hey, this is happening in a few weeks. So I didn't make a trade that day, but my first major poor decision down the slippery slope was I shared it with a friend outside my firm at a prop trading firm. And we were just catching up later that day after she called me. I wasn't calling him to give him a tip. It just came up through conversation where he was losing money. He was looking for any type of short-term trade. I said, I'm not trading this, but do with this what you want. I told him everything right there. Just so people are clear, pretty much in any country in the world, I could now be at least civilly charged for insider trading by sharing that tip. And I hadn't traded yet. He tells his whole firm. He calls me back. The stock is ticking up every day a little bit. He's IMing me at the time. Are you in? Are you in? Are you in? The woman who had tipped me told me she had her entire brokerage account in this stock for this event. I'm still holding onto my moral compass, but it's certainly fading. And after a few more days of just sort of this bombardment, are you in? Are you in? I kind of had some FOMO. Like, these guys are going to make millions. She's going to make millions. Am I just going to sit here and watch this happen? And the opportunity, it's very important to know when an employee crosses the line, there's usually an opportunity to do that. There's a rationalization and opportunity, and there's a pressure, the fraud triangle. So I had pressure now to make money every month. The opportunity is I could buy a stock in our portfolio and not talk to my boss as long as it was less than 1% of the assets we manage for clients. I remember calculating, what is a 0.9% position? How many shares of the stock is that? Putting it into the trade entry system, click 14,000 shares of Kronos, I remember. And once I clicked send and it was executed, I committed securities fraud. And a few more days went by. The news came out exactly as she described. I'd love to tell you here that I freaked out. I did initially. I sort of had a little bit of a panic attack, like, oh my God, this is actually happening. But after a few more minutes went by, I kind of felt like, oh my gosh, I had an adrenaline rush. Like, now I'm part of this illicit in group of these people who I know are doing it. And that's how I continued to justify it. My boss never asked me about this trade or the next three trades that happened. It was all the same fact pattern. She would call 0.9% positions. My boss saying something like, oh, it's one of those, but don't tell me how you're doing this. So being willfully blind to my trades, not asking me questions. And so today I talk a lot about tone at the top. So if you're not asking questions, that's not a great tone. And he was the closest thing I had to a mentor, 15 years older than me. He had followed my career as a young analyst, hired me to be his junior partner, his analyst. And so he's sort of fueling my rationalizations. He knows exactly what I'm doing. He's not asking me questions. Four more trades. My firm managed $100 million at our hedge fund at its peak. We made $1 million in the four trades, so 1% of performance. We were long emerging markets that year. We were up 31%. With the trades, we were up 30% without the trade. So what's the point? And of the $1 million, my personal take at 29 years old, the price of my career was $46,000. People often think, oh, Tipper exited for millions. No, the punchline is $46,000 at 29 years old was the price of professional suicide, to put it very bluntly. I threw away my career at 29 for 46 grand. And a few months after that fourth trade, I was going to drop off some dry cleaning in New York outside of my apartment in July of 2008, a really muggy summer morning in Manhattan. I stepped on the sidewalk and this guy behind me said, are you Thomas Covey Harden? In New York City, it's 6:30 in the morning. If anybody says your full name in New York City that morning, you're probably in trouble. I turned around, two FBI agents, dark suits, wallets out. If anybody's seen these American crime shows with the FBI, it was exactly like that. Come sit down with us. We sat down at a fast food restaurant. He said, look, man, we know about your four trades. We know that you were just down in Georgia visiting your baby nephew for his baptism last weekend, and they knew his name. And my first thought was, oh my God, my parents are going to kill me, right? What are they going to say? They worked hard their whole life so I could have this opportunity. They're going to kill me. It wasn't about prison or anything. It was like that. And I thought, oh my God, my wife's going to leave me. She had no idea about these trades. We just got married. She's going to just think, what the heck, and leave. And then I thought, this might impact my career. Oh my God, I might be going to prison. So I started telling them everything. The FBI starts writing it down. I say, you shouldn't talk to the FBI. But I also knew I was guilty. And so I would learn later, it's very rare just to start confessing that day. I had just converted to Catholicism for marriage. So I'd gone through that confession. And I went to the FBI here. I had my own confession with the FBI. Told them everything. And they gave me a mandate to help them build some of these cases in the industry. I asked them, should I talk to a lawyer first? And they said, don't talk to a lawyer. So they're not supposed to say that, but they're going to, play by their own set of ethics in building these cases. So I'm happy to pause there or keep going with the cooperation.
Please keep going, Tom. I'm actually just listening to the story. I get nervous being in the financial industry. I've sort of got my hands clenched as you're going, and the FBI is stopping you.
Yeah.
So please, please do continue on the journey and tip breaks, and we'll come back and go through some of the themes.
So the FBI, asked me who are the worst actors in the industry, and it wasn't really people I knew. Normally, if you're going to wear a wire for the FBI, you would have to make a decision: do I wear this against a colleague or a friend who I probably shared the information with? Those individuals had already worn a wire on me. So I thought, how can I help them? And I started giving them names of, 48-year-old hedge fund managers in Silicon Valley. I'm a 29-year-old analyst in New York. I would build relationships with people at conferences, at, the investment bank, big tech stock conferences. I'd meet them for coffee. My cover story was, I'm a young analyst. I'm looking for a job. It's 2008. I'm probably going to lose my job. I'm having a terrible year, which is a good cover story. So I meet with these hedge fund managers who I suspected were trading on information. And at some point I had to ask them, how did they also get their information? But it was a very awkward conversation if you're a target of the FBI. And I'm saying, great to see you, good catching up. So remember 3 years ago when you traded those stocks, what would you say if you were ever asked as to why you did that? Usually they would stop and think, why is this young guy asking me these questions who I don't even know that well? This would go on for 2 years. The FBI never told me how I was doing. In fact, they told me I wasn't good at wearing the wire. I was so nervous. I would fill the silence. I would just keep talking. And at one point I said, hey guys, it's my first time doing this. There's no training. I'm just going with the wind of this. One guy high up their list, I got him 15 conversations. He would say nothing, always change the subject. One Sunday afternoon, he gave me a call. He says, Tom, we need to have dinner tonight. We need to talk. I told the FBI. They got excited. They met me at the train station in Manhattan, gave me the wire. I took the train out to Connecticut, where this guy lived. He picked me up at the train station, and he says, Tom, good to see you. I brought swim trunks for you. We're going swimming at my mother's house.
Oh,
so unbelievable situation. I think people internationally are familiar with that show, The Sopranos. So all these ideas were going through my head. I played it cool. I said, let's go swimming. I was able to get myself out of that situation very closely where he didn't see the wire. He starts asking me questions in the pool about, this and that. And then he actually said, he has one final question for me. And he said, have you been approached by the SEC? And truthfully, I could say, no, not the SEC, because it was the FBI. It was law enforcement, not the regulator. He started confessing to all the questions I'd asked. And once he saw I wasn't wearing a wire, he was never charged by the SEC or the FBI. And up until a few years ago, he was actually still managing outside money for investors. But he never had me in as a guest speaker. So that was the craziest situation. Eventually, 20 people were arrested in the fall of 2009. I mentioned two teenage daughters. My first daughter was born that week. And then the next day, the FBI called me and said, turn on CNBC. 20 people were in handcuffs in the hedge fund industry. The FBI windbreakers, the news cameras just happened to be there when the hedge fund executives in handcuffs, the perp walk, they call it. And CNBC kept talking about Tipper X as this key informant for the FBI. I had no idea I was Tipper X, but I'm an analyst, so I could figure it out. Oh my God, I'm Tipper X. I called the FBI, am I Tipper X? And they said, yes, you should talk to a lawyer now, 2 years into this. And I called a lawyer that was a defense attorney in New York. I said, hey, so I'm Tipper X in all these cases that came out today. And the FBI said, we should talk. And he said, who was your attorney the last 2 years? I said, you're the first lawyer I've spoken to. They told me not to talk to anybody. He said, Tom, you're supposed to call me the first day the FBI approached you. And again, I said, it's my first time doing this. So pretty straightforward for me. Eventually, my name became public. So the shame of my name being Tipper X. Nobody expected it was Thomas Harden, you know, a 29-year-old analyst. People kept thinking Tipper X was this sort of well-to-do, you know, well-known person. And then, you know, I was a nobody, financial analyst at the time, but you kind of figure out who your true friends are. Lost, you know, understandably several connections in the industry, most connections in the industry. You know, there's sort of a sense of like, do I even trust this guy? How could it be Tom? And then I wasn't sentenced for 7 years till 2015, 7 years after the FBI approached me. So basically all of my 30s were gone. You know, I would apply for jobs, but, you know, it's a reputational crisis, reputational damage, and understandably nobody would hire me. I was finally sentenced. They didn't send me to prison because I helped them out so much, but still took a felony conviction. And honestly, I had no idea how I would go on with my life professionally. I was a stay-at-home father. At least I had that, you know, responsibility. I felt some type of reason sort of to sort of keep going. I don't think I was ever suicidal, but just sort of like looking for to get out of this depression. And I had the two daughters to be there for and really figure this out for. How was I going to sort of support them and what was I going to do? I really had no idea. So this dragged on for quite a long time.
Sure, Tom, this is an absolutely extraordinary journey. Absolutely extraordinary journey. And so many themes there that I'd love to pick up. That triangle that you mentioned of the pressure, the opportunity and the rationalization. And just putting myself in your shoes. You've grown up, accolades. You've done well academically. You're the oldest and you're an example to your brothers. Then you get accepted to an Ivy League college. You go and do well there. Then you get into quite sought after industries and investment banking. And then in this hedge fund world, and then, you know, you see these things that are happening around you, and I'm sure this felt like, well, we're not criminals in a sense. All of us are in suits and we're smart people and all of this. Just putting myself in those shoes, I think a lot of empathy for the situation as a whole. I'd love to pick out then some of the themes from your journey and lessons that you think that holds for people like myself who are in positions of trust, professionals who are in positions of trust in the investment industry and many other industries. I'd love to pick out some of the themes in the environment that create the ground for things like this to happen. And then just some of the more personal lessons. What kind of messages or things were you saying to yourself in your head, rationalizing the actions?
Sure. Yeah. So I agree with everything you said. And I think when people feel like it can never be them in this situation, that's when you're most susceptible. So I always tell people to have a healthy paranoia, that one decision could start that slippery slope. It comes back so much, the fraud triangle, those rationalizations for me of the three was the biggest. I said, as I'm waiting, before I placed the trade, there was a few days that went by. I said, it seems like everybody's doing it. I can tell you the last 9 years of engaging with companies that have had, some companies have had issues that they bring me in to discuss that. The number one rationalization where people get in trouble is saying, everybody does this, right? And that's usually not true. You know, how would that decision look on the front of the Wall Street Journal? That's one way to frame that.
Absolutely.
I said, you know, I said I'm still a good person, right? So I was able to actually do what's called moral licensing, where I'm a faithful husband, which not a lot of people on Wall Street couldn't say that. So I was a faithful husband. I converted to Catholicism, so I have that religion. You know, I volunteer at the church, write checks to charity. So I was able to sort of tell myself, you're a good guy, so you can make these four trades because that's only like 1% of your life, right? So we're able to sort of say we're good people because that's just like four trades. It's not who I am. And so that was a very easy thing for me to do in my head. I was actually able to say, you know, who am I hurting? Kind of who's the victim? Like I knew I was committing a crime, but I just felt I was buying the stock before everybody else. I think it would have been harder if it was a Ponzi scheme, like I was actually taking investors' money and doing something else. But it was actually very easy to rationalize buying a stock before everybody else. You know, who's the victim? And in some countries, insider trading is actually still not even illegal. So it's easy to rationalize. And really, I told myself, you know, I'll do it just this once and never do it again. And that's also a big one in my training engagements where we just say, I'll do it just this once. And it's never just this once. It's a lot easier to stick to your sort of principles 100% of the time than 98% of the time, because just this once becomes more than once. And I really feel like one big takeaway behaviorally is I made a decision in isolation. So I didn't really, I had no idea who compliance was. So I speak with a lot of compliance organizations. Where was your compliance officer? I had no idea who they were. And if I knew who they were, they were just, you know, impeding our commercial success, right? They were always trying to get in the way. That's the way I viewed it, you know, nameless, faceless. So I didn't have that relationship to talk through anything. And in my 20s, I didn't really have a mentor. So my boss was my closest thing to my mentor. Obviously, not a great mentor talking about him being willfully blind. And so I think had I been sharing what I was seeing in the industry with any type of mentor, maybe somebody even outside of finance who just has a moral compass and said, you know, you won't believe what I'm seeing. It seems like all these funds are doing it. You know, the options are going off. This woman just called me. I'm thinking about taking a flyer one time. I also said I was taking a flyer because that's a euphemism for illicit conduct. I never did say, hey, I'm insider trading. And so by calling it taking a flyer, you feel less poorly about it. And that's very common in other types of frauds. But if I was telling that, right, so if somebody says pays a bribe, they never say I'm paying a bribe. They say I'm paying a toll or paying a tender or I'm paying something to get the business. Very, very common in certain, obviously, certain regions in the world. But had I been sharing this with a mentor, the right mentor, I think, would have slapped me around. So you think about the iceberg underwater and above the water, you can see the $46,000. And I clearly wasn't thinking about the money. I was just thinking about now I'm part of this group. But the right mentor could have showed me underwater what I'm not seeing. There's your career. There's your reputation. There's your future opportunity cost of 20 years in the hedge fund business gone. That reframe may have stopped me because it was very easy for me to override my own sense of who I am. I'm a good guy. I'll do it one time. Overriding a mentor and still doing it, I would have been letting the mentor down. Psychologically, there's a study where it's actually much harder to do that if you're letting somebody else down in the situation, but it's very easy to convince yourself in isolation that it's okay to do. So that's one thing that I always caution people on. Whatever it is, if you ever feel like you have to make a decision in isolation, then you're going to catch yourself and that behavior and just start asking some questions around that.
Thank you so much, Tom. The self-talk is so, so important. It comes through on so many of these items that you've mentioned there on the rationalization, as well as the just this once, which links up with the slippery slope, which you've also said multiple times in this conversation. It'll never be the just this once that's in your head. In fact, it's likely to get worse. You'll do more and more, because of that slippery slope. The one bit that I'm curious on that mentor as well, did you have a coach at that stage?
No coach, no formal training at all.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing really, no career coach or mentor or anything, just sort of on my own, sort of navigating the Wild West at the time. Yeah.
Okay. That's something that I think, I guess, has changed with time as well. It has become a lot more normal to have an executive coach, even in your sort of late 20s, in industries with a lot of sort of public trust in them. Okay. And, you know, if I cast my mind back to this time, it wasn't normal for insider trading to be prosecuted. These are very powerful people in society very often and et cetera. And it wasn't common. And you mentioned 20 people got arrested. You know, I obviously know the trials. And if we were to say some of the names, these would be known to people in the financial industry even today. So If I just cast my mind back there with that big shock, I remember that there were even some suicides from people who were involved in that trial. This was really, really big. But you weren't one of them. You're here. You've turned your life around phenomenally. You're telling us earlier about your daughters and your marathons. And we haven't even spoken about the company subsequently, TipRx, which we'll get to. But tell me, how did you turn your life around from those really darkest days?
So there's a couple things as I think about that. My wife stayed with me, and 85% of marriages, when a spouse picks up a sort of white-collar fraud charge, and it's usually the husband, so the wife or the spouse, whoever it is, usually leaves. So she stayed with me. It was not easy, of course. I could only talk to her about this. I couldn't even talk to my parents until my name became public. So she became my sort of coach through this, or my psychiatrist. I didn't talk to any medical professionals, just talked to her. It wasn't easy, but she stayed with me. So that helped me sort of get through it and not get to a very dark place thinking about suicide. I hate to even think about if she walked out the door, which again, 85% of spouses would have done at that point, what would have happened? I also had to accept responsibility for years. When these names came out, I felt that the four worst people actually were not charged. So we had some big names, but I felt that those people weren't charged. Like the guy at the swimming pool, I felt he was one of the worst, and he was never charged. And I kind of felt I hate to say it, like, I kind of felt like a victim at one point. Like, why was I charged for $46,000 and this guy made millions? And I think that got me nowhere. And so one day, again, my wife, she's very tough, very loving. She said, "Is that getting you anywhere, Tom?" Dwelling on that. I said, "No." She's like, "Well, stop it. All right. So we have to move on. You have to actually figure out how you're going to provide a life for us." She was working, but she didn't make enough to cover the cost of our living expenses at the time. So I had to figure it out. So accepting responsibility, yes, I made those decisions. And for years, I also told myself I made mistakes. And I realized later, I didn't make any mistakes. I made bad decisions. And actually, if we call our bad decisions mistakes, we're not owning them. And that was a real unlock for me. Like, wow, I didn't think about that until I was actually speaking about this. One of the first talks I did, somebody corrected me saying, "No, you didn't make mistakes. You made bad decisions." That was an unlock. I also had to not live in isolation. I had to actually sort of reach out to the people I knew, or as I mentioned, you figure out who your true friends are. And that was helpful. I got 4 emails that day when my name became Tipper X on the front of the Wall Street Journal from college friends at Penn saying, "Hey, if you need to get a coffee or drink together, happy to meet with you." And then the hardest part, and I still struggle with it, but I think I'm through most of that, is you have to forgive yourself. And so I dealt with a lot of shame, where shame is I'm a terrible person and did the wrong thing. Guilt is I definitely did the wrong thing, but maybe I'm a regular person, not a terrible person. And that took years and years. Even the first few years of my speaking engagements were very dark, where I was still dealing with a lot of shame. So today we have this big mental health discussion, and some of that comes back to the shame and the guilt, where people are living in shame when the guilt can be healthy, but the shame is not healthy for anybody. So those are just a few things that got me through it.
Jeez, what a story. I'm still a bit taken by it, Tom. That's you know, as we move on to the next phase of the conversation and talk a bit about now Tipper X, the company, the brand, and ethics training and compliance training, I think you have uniquely on this planet a foundation for your role that you do in ethics and compliance training. And I really appreciate you sharing this conversation and so openly. So let's move on then to Tipper X, the company and the brand, that not Tipper X, the FBI informant. Yeah. So what is Tipper X, and what was your motivation for starting it?
So yeah, Tipper X is my company today. I'm actually trademarking the word Tipper X. So in the next FBI cases, they'll have to skip over X, because that'll be my trademark. That's what they name me. So that's something, or maybe I can license it to them. that's down the line.
Really, still available, Tom. You got
it. It's still TipperX.com, TipperX.tv. I think I have them all. But that's something that I just embraced. So in my situation, people that have gone through this, something in the criminal justice system, you'll get emails all the time from reputation managers saying, "Oh, we found something bad about you. You know, for a certain price, we'll take that off Google," which people actually, most people do that. They don't want the bad stuff on their Google. I just figure I'll lean into it. I'll own it. I'll own these decisions, and maybe it'll help people. I never thought about really speaking about it until the FBI invited me to speak. So I've given over 600 talks the last 9 years. Talk number one was at the FBI in New York. They called me after I was sentenced, and it's always a restricted number. And I thought, what do these guys want now? And my wife, of course, said, "What did you do?" She stayed with me. I don't know. Answered the phone. And they said they had arrested actually 80 people. And they said of the 80 total people they arrested, I was the youngest. And I made the least amount of money, the $46,000. I thought they were rubbing it in. I said, "Well, I was actually trying not to get caught. Do you have any other sort of insults for me?" They said, "No." It was really interesting. The why'd you do it? The fraud triangle, the pressures. And so they asked me just to speak at the FBI. And then they encouraged me to go out and share the story with the industry. But it started very slow. I didn't really have a commercial opportunity for several months. I didn't know that this was something I could even pursue. But I did just start speaking everywhere that would have me in for a free presentation. So a lot of universities, some of the top universities, were willing to have me in for no fee. I spoke at public libraries. So I had audiences of 20-year-olds at universities where it really landed well. They understood it. And I actually had 85-year-olds at public libraries. One of my first engagements, there was 4 octogenarians. Maybe a 90-year-old man came up and told me that my talk made him think about every decision his whole life. And so I realized there was power with it. Wow. And then eventually I emailed a conference and they said, "How much do you charge?" I gave them a price and started doing it professionally. And then once I got paid once, I told my wife that she could leave her job. She was not happy at her job. She had to work for us. I felt so kind of emasculated, not to be stereotypical, but just as the husband, not being able to provide. It's just something I felt I wanted to do. And so once I had one paid engagement, I told her, you don't have to work anymore. You can be with the girls, because she missed him so much commuting to New York City. And she said, you're crazy. You got paid one time. I said, I have to make this work. I have to accept responsibility. I have to make it work. And it turned into a real passion to do this for a living now for the last, I can't believe it's been 9 years. And so that's how it all started.
Yeah, that's, look, I've lived through one of those talks, and you know, it was earlier in my career, and it struck the fear of God into me as I entered the financial industry, as you know very well. So I think it's extremely powerful. And that's, so 900 talks, 600 talks over the last 9 years, and varying entities as well. So I'd love to learn, maybe if you can just give us an example of maybe for one of your clients or that you've spoke at or engaged with. What kinds of things are you working with them on? What kinds of problems are you helping them solve within the organizations?
So it's interesting because, sometimes I'll prospect a little bit, but usually I've just found through referrals or somebody emails me. But sometimes people think, well, you know, nothing's bad happening in our company, so we don't have to have you come speak to us. Like, actually, that's not the point of all. It's preventative, right? So it's a little bit of an injection of a vaccine or something of a bad story to help prevent, you know, widespread, something happening in the company. But some examples are the investment banks I'm pretty busy with. They have large hiring classes. I mentioned I was an analyst back in the day. And there was a bank that recently had me in for what's called a conduct
week.
They talk about
out of interest. We didn't talk about it. Which bank was that that you were an analyst at in your own analyst days?
Oh, back in the day, it was called DLJ. So nobody knows about that anymore. It was bought by Credit Suisse. Yeah. So I was working for Ken Mullis, his group in Los Angeles at the time before he started Mullis and Company. So back in the 100-hour work week days. So that's where I was.
In the heyday of the industry in some ways.
It really was. The high yield business was really thriving then after Drexel shut down. But I still do work with investment banks today in a different way, obviously sharing my story.
Yeah.
One bank had me in. They were having an issue with traders spoofing orders, so putting in fake orders and taking them away on the desk. And they were also having an issue with their AML teams, their anti-money laundering second line team, with some of their processes where they had some things actually come through that they should have flagged. So the regulator was onto them. So I shared my story, and I focused more on the mindset, the culture, and kind of how like this misconduct starts, what we talked about, how it takes root. And after sharing my story, I'll often do smaller breakout sessions that are more targeted to the specific team. So I work with the trading team to talk about how traders might actually justify spoofing, or every other bank is doing it. And then I work with the AML team, who's not on the front line, but they're more in the compliance role, about how they might miss red flags when they're under pressure to onboard clients quickly. They had a lot of sort of quotas. You have to onboard so many clients at the time, and they actually missed some major money laundering risks. And so through that, I remember one employee told me it really helped him understand how somebody who, as you mentioned, you know, not thinking themselves as a criminal, could actually cross a line without thinking they're doing sort of anything criminal. And so I think what I try to do is have that shift in perspective every time. That's kind of one of my key outcomes, I hope, with my sessions. And I followed up with the bank, as I usually do with all my clients, what sort of landed. And the bank told me they're going to include more of a narrative-based approach to conduct training rather than rules and regs. Less check the box, watch this video, check the box, more storytelling. And they've actually seen an uptick in their employees actually speaking up. And this was actually in a country where there's more of a hierarchical structure, where in the US we say speak up, everybody sort of feels comfortable, but in some countries, nobody feels comfortable speaking up because there's more of a hierarchy, and they were actually starting to see that more. So that's kind of my goal. Yes, sometimes it's to scare people, but also it's sort of like to make people think and actually cause change inside the companies.
That's wonderful. And yeah, changes to the environment make such a huge difference to the eventual outcomes. I'm interested, these lessons that you've spoken about through your journey, and which you work with then with some of your clients, like the triangle that you spoke about, some of the things around, you know, it being a slippery slope and, you know, I'll only do it just this once, all of that. You've worked with entities across the world. You've spoken across the world. Have you found that these lessons are, differ quite materially across different cultures or different parts of the world, or actually that they're quite universal?
So yeah, I've spoken either in person or a lot of virtually too during the pandemic in like 13 countries. And Yes, you know, the accents change, the laws are different, but I think the psychology is pretty much the same. There's pressure, there's rationalization, there's isolation. Those patterns are universal, but I would say what does vary is how openly people talk about misconduct or what they might be seeing in the markets or at competition or competitors, and also how leaders actually model accountability. So I would say in the U.S., we're more open to sharing personal failures and that sort of redemption arc. Whereas in parts of Asia or the Middle East, there can be more cultural hesitation, maybe to speak publicly about mistakes or bad decisions. And especially, as I mentioned, in those hierarchical environments, which are much more prevalent in those regions. In Europe, there's more of a focus on having a strong emphasis on frameworks and governance. But my story still hits home on the same emotional notes when we talk about sort of that human side decision making. And my only virtual engagements in Africa have actually been in for groups in South Africa. And I would say I haven't done a lot, but I would be curious your thoughts. I think there's a heightened sensitivity to issues of trust and transformation. And so I think obviously it's shaped by a very different kind of historical and political context. So I would say people in those talks with me, as far as I could tell online, were incredibly engaged. And it was just not about ethics. It was more about how leadership and culture kind of has to evolve to support integrity across, you know, very diverse teams. So the culture might change, but the core lessons, how we rationalize, how culture shapes behavior and the need for psychological safety, that's like surprisingly pretty consistent across borders.
I think that I identify with that. I think that matches up broadly with my experience working in various parts of the world as well. Not quite 13 or 14 as you have, fewer than that, but still quite varied parts of the world. And I think some of these are frankly just elements of the human experience. I think all these sorts of rationalizations, how we tell ourselves we're good people, even, you know, while doing something that's wrong in some way, et cetera. As you say, I think a lot of them are quite universal and simply part of the human experience. One question I'm interested on is we're in a time of a lot of change, AI and technology. The financial industry looks very different today to what it did 20 years ago, but the humans are still the same. So I'm intrigued in this world where AI moving quickly, technology moving quickly, how for you is it impacting? It's both ethics and even broader than that, because what you do is not only ethics, it's leadership, it's culture. So I know that's a very broad question, but how is it impacting your work?
Yeah, as of now, I would say, you know, with AI, like AI yet won't commit the fraud. Humans still commit the frauds potentially with the AI. I look at it pretty in two ways. Optimistically, ethics education can be made much more immersive, much more personalized. If anybody, you know, is just good at prompting the LLMs, and it makes it widely accessible. So AI kind of driven platforms can adapt ethics content to like individual learners, or you can simulate situations. You know, virtual reality lets users experience real-world ethical dilemmas. I now have a workshop where it's sort of like choose your own adventure where, okay, you make this decision, click here. All right, here's another set. And I work with the client to customize that a little bit with LLMs. It kind of really made it really specific to that company. And so that's something that we can do today that we couldn't do a few years ago. You know, it enables real-time feedback. So it can turn ethics into like a continuous learning process that, rather than a one-off event. I would say at the same time, you know, the challenges are often discussed, the algorithmic bias, the privacy concerns. You don't want to outsource your decisions to the AI. So I think those issues now demand their kind of own place in the ethics curricula around the world. And I'd also say there's a risk of over-reliance on it. Everybody's talking about it today. If it's not thoughtfully used, you know, AI can actually reduce ethics education to more of what I call kind of like superficial engagement. So the heart of it, we've talked about this, it must still be human. So critical thinking, moral courage, and empathy are still human. So I think it should enhance, not replace, our own sort of instincts. I see the future of ethics education kind of lies in using AI as a tool to kind of deepen our reflection, but not to automate it. That's the way I'm thinking about it.
Got it. Well, it's exciting to see what the future will hold, with technology changing so quickly. So on that note of the future, I'd love to ask you for where you are now, both as Tom, the person, as well as TipperX, the company and the brand. What are you excited about in the future? What are some of the exciting things in the pipeline?
So thank you for asking. Last year, a publisher reached out, one of the top 10 publishers in the world reached out to me and said, why do you not have a book? I said, I don't know. I just like speaking. So they said, you should write a book. And so now I wrote a book. It's going to come out in February. I have to get through my final draft to get it to them in August. So if people are listening, February of 2026, Wired on Wall Street will be out through Wiley Publishing. I think in most countries where Amazon is. So that's going to be out. It's going to be so much more than just my 1 hour usual presentation. So much of what we actually discussed today, the relationship dynamics with my family, and some of the learnings that I've learned. So that's going to be out. I'm trying to figure out other ways that I can kind of bring myself to market other than keynote speeches. So I'm working on some courses that I'd hope to have out there by the time the book is out, where maybe a company doesn't want to bring me in for a speech, but they can have their employees take some courses about, you know, some of the elements from my story. I'm working on, I mentioned I trademarked TIPRX, like a TIPRX certification that might be a continuous thing where I sort of come in every year, bring real world stories that were from the past year, those insights, and have continued learning. Cause right now I'm sort of in and out one time maybe, and I want to have sort of a continuous, and maybe actually have companies want a TIPRX certification just to say I was there and they had the training. So maybe that's something that they could show a regulator that would be a good thing. So those are some things I'm thinking about, but I'm really enjoying this work. I find it fascinating. Like, why do we make these decisions? Even if it wasn't my story, I think I still find it fascinating. Why does a well-educated person who did the right thing most of his life go down the slippery slope? So I always am reading the latest psychology books about behavior and trying to kind of stay up to speed with that, because I always want to have my insights fresh, because the story isn't going to, it's going to get older every year, but the insights and that psychology, the human experience you mentioned, doesn't change because we're all humans.
It's universal, and that's why it's interesting to us all. So I'm really looking forward to February then, with Wired on Wall Street being the book that'll be out, and really looking forward to reading that. I mean, just as you were talking about these, you know, asking yourself these questions, why do we do this? Someone is you know, made all the right decisions in so many other parts of their lives, and has so much to lose. It feels in some respects like finance has every decade sort of has its fraud, which is common in the industry. In the 80s, it could be some of the stuff that happened around junk bonds, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, some of the stuff around mortgages and the mortgage fraud. I'd probably say over the last decade, I mean, there's been quite a lot, but I'd probably say crypto is up there. There's so much that goes on in that world that is dodgy. And asking yourself this question of why do people with so much to lose do this? I think the one that immediately springs to mind, which people will know because it was in the papers a lot at the time, was the global CEO of McKinsey, you know, worked so hard to get into that position. And then, you know, sharing secrets from, this is a while back now, but I think it was a Procter & Gamble board meeting. And that ultimately being, you know, as you say, front page of the Wall Street Journal, front page of the New York Times, and bringing to a very tangible sense that question that people always ask you, how would you feel if this decision you're making were on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, front page of the New York Times, or whatever publication it is. So the work that you're doing is so important. Let's not be having this conversation another decade and we're talking about the 2020s being the decade of whatever fraud it is at that time, and any impact you can have even on a single life is meaningful, as you know. So we'll be watching your progress, Tom. As I come to the end of the interview, I ask the same concluding question to all of our guests, and I'd love to hear from you. Please tell us about one of your favorite teachers or educators or professors.
I think as far as I would call her an educator, so it would be my grandmother. She grew up on a farm in rural Tennessee during the Great Depression back in the 1930s. And, you know, she had the grit, intelligence, and unwavering values. Again, that work ethic that was in my family. She actually started teaching herself the stock market when she was in her 60s through reading the Wall Street Journal. I remember when I was really little, she said she found a guy named Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway and started reading his letters when she was in her 60s. And she had her Charles Schwab rep. She would call him every day about her stock portfolio. She would show me analyst reports, talk about PE ratios before I knew what that was. And so by the time I was in, she was in her 70s when I went to college, she was actually able to fund some of my tuition at University of Pennsylvania through her investing. And so she didn't just teach me about investing. She showed me what it means to live with integrity, right? And I certainly went sideways at a certain point in my life, but I think that's what I strive to do now.
That's wonderful. What a wonderful tribute to your grandmother. And I certainly hope that she bought some Berkshire Hathaway shares when she was telling you about this young man called Warren Buffett from Omaha, Nebraska. It's an absolutely beautiful story. Thank you so much, Tom. I've really enjoyed the conversation throughout your journey, and finally now also learning about TIPRX and some of the more tangibles on ethics and compliance and things that I'll carry across in my life, and hopefully many of our listeners will as well. Thank you so much for the time.